This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Save big money and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of body plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all 4.5-inch body plants are on sale through May 5th. Head to the Menards Garden Center to get your garden growing and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Everybody loves a lover. I'm a lover. Everybody loves me. Anyhow, that's how I feel. Wow, I feel just like a Pollyanna.
Hello, young lovers.
Welcome.
Hello.
This is medicinal. I'm lying in bed right now for this.
That's so good. That's the spirit.
Commitment.
Yeah. Normally, you would be here with us in our bed. Mm. I'm sure, you know, we'll have another opportunity to do that someday.
One can only hope.
Yeah, exactly. So welcome to another installment of beloved number one podcast, In Bed with Nick and Megan. number one in the ratings of my mind.
Yeah. We're number one in our category.
In our category of the podcasts that we do.
That's right. We are number one.
In my category, for sure.
I mean, in my mind
as well.
Yes. So that... those dulcet tones belong to Catherine Hahn, a beautiful, amazing, funny, incredible actress and writer. And so let's see, how do we all know each other? I feel like you and I had met like here and there-ish at some something, and then you and Nick did a movie together.
Yeah. I mean, I had done a show called Crossing Jordan, which was a procedural on NBC while you were doing Will and Grace. Mm-hmm. And so I'd always seen you at kind of events and just had, I mean, worshipped you from afar. I was always like the scrappy procedural behind at the like TCA events.
I had seen you in a scene with, was it Paul Rudd, where you guys like violently French each other in some movie?
No, the thing that for me,
so we're funny.
Wanderlust.
No,
and I was like, that?
No, no,
it, no.
It's Adam Scott. It's in Step Brothers.
Oh, Anchorman.
No, in Step Brothers, where you and John C. Reilly in the bathroom.
Oh my God. We just showed my kids that movie and I realized I had to fast forward every single scene I was in. Like as if that I was not, I had to erase myself completely from that film.
When you did that kiss, it really, I was like, who is that? And I like wrote your name down and was like, okay, we're going to be friends.
And then we really got to know each other while Nick, you and I were doing We're the Millers.
That's right.
And you guys were shooting in Santa Fe, right? And so then, and I went to visit, and then you and I went to dinner a couple of times.
Yeah, the most beautiful place. Because, yeah, right, we didn't have, for some reason, like, I had a lot of off time in Santa Fe, so we got to spend some time together, you and I, Megan.
Yeah, that was so awesome. Fun.
And then I had already spent some time with you, Nick, on Parks.
Right.
Which was a dream.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And also Philly Justice, the...
let's not forget...
imaginary justice. Lawyer procedural born of Parks.
Oh, that's so funny.
Which was the best. And also, can I tell you that there were, remember there were t-shirts made of that show? And my daughter, now that's her sleep shirt.
Oh, nice.
It's so surreal. I love
that, you know, I love that they went out of their way to pick a title for that fictitious show that was so exactly, it could actually be a real, I mean,
yeah.
Instead of making it something a little crazier,
right.
They went full
Philly Justice.
Philly Justice.
Philly Justice. Because it perfect.
It wouldn't be denied between you and Rashida and Adam Scott and Rob Lowe and Paul Rudd. It was the dream cast of like.
Yes, it was amazing.
It was like 1993 lawyer show. Right.
Yeah. And then remember, we actually shot, like, there was like a dedicated day or like a half a day. Like, there was stuff shot.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah.
In your like courtroom.
What happened to.
I don't know what
happened.
It's got
to be out there somewhere.
Yeah. I don't know. It was like a dedicated, or just at least like a half a day. There was like a dedicated.
It was like a trailer.
A Saturday. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It was fantastic.
That's so funny.
To find, yeah, it was Dylan. I can't remember.
We're the Millers was a good movie. That was a fun movie. I remember you had a fake, you wore fake boobs that were like giant, yes. Droopy Midwestern boobs and
yes.
Like beanbag. They were beanbags.
Yeah.
Swinging around.
Like bird seed boobs. I just want, yeah. Yes, exactly. And then I had a fanny pack and my step up Skechers. Like I wanted the shoes that were also like helped you exercise at the same time. Like you remember those tennis shoes?
I bet you got in really good shape from wearing those.
Oh, that was actually a ball. I mean, Nick, that was so fun to work with you. That was a ball. And I was like, couldn't believe how well that movie turned out. Like sometimes you have no idea.
Yeah.
It's
but
really
it really
good.
Landed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was, really
it was a blast.
Special shout out must be voiced to Jennifer Aniston's pole dance in that movie because that was mind-blowing.
It was incredible.
Spectacular.
I mean, that woman is from another planet. She's so nice. She's such a good actress. She's so funny. And then
I mean, one of the kindest, like most decent human beings. Yeah, no, she's a miracle.
Yeah.
For
there's
sure.
The bad part. So and then of course for those listening, you know Catherine from Mrs. Fletcher and Transparent. Ooh, Transparent.
Woo.
So good. And
Fireworks.
Yeah. I love Dick. Best title of any show ever.
That's
based
that's,
on a book.
That's great, honey, but let's get back to our guest.
Oh, wow. Okay. I just can't stop talking about it, guys. I really love it.
She
I
just
really
loves
do.
Dick, guys.
Look, I just want to say it.
Let's take a brief intermission.
So many great things. And I love that you are so incredibly funny, but you've also been able to, you know, cross over into things that are more dramatic or at least have a balance of, you know, comedic and dramatic elements. You can sort of play a real person and not just be, you know, a big caricature all the time.
Hmm.
That's so nice.
I mean, it's not anything. I mean, thank you. I don't even know. It's so, it's so chaotic. Like, I don't, you know, in my 20s or whatever, after I went to school and I landed in New York, it was never. I never wanted to or needed to go one direction or the other. It was kind of, it was like standing in line for the backstage at Astor Place. Do you remember the backstage? Did you guys ever deal? You did, Megan. Did you ever, Nick?
Yeah, out here.
It was like a magazine, or you know, like a newspaper that you would go to get auditions. Basically, oh, yeah. Like back in the day.
We had it. We had it in Chicago and LA.
Yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't like I really gravitated towards sketch or needed to do like improv or anything. I always thought I was going to be a theater actor. Like, I never really thought it was going to be comedy. So it was, I don't know. It's I love taking a big swing as much as I do the other stuff. So it does kind of feel like it's been a little bit of chaos this career. in terms of the gigs, but
I think you're one of the best actresses out there. You're one of my favorites.
Oh God, that's damn sure. it!
Yeah.
Now, what is that movie? Up. We talked about this when I saw you at that party on Oscar night. We talked about that first movie, that indie movie that you did that Jill Soloway directed.
Oh, Afternoon Delight.
Yeah, see, we went to a screening of that. You were there, actually, and we loved it.
I remember.
It. Yeah, we loved it.
Yeah,
you said it
so
was
so much that you guys were both there.
It was so good. You were really great in it. Mm. So, and you said that, you know, you didn't know making it, that it, you know, how it was going to turn out. You weren't really sure, but it came out. It was great.
Yeah, that was like a real, I mean, I knew that it was special. I knew that it was going to be special just because I had never been asked to be the lead in something before. So I knew the experience was going to feel different because I was going to be carrying something in a way that I hadn't since school. Like, I think when, again, like back to school, like that feeling of having to carry something and those parts that felt like there was a weight to them and that I was asked to do something that I, that used parts of me that I hadn't been asked to in this business, I guess, so I knew that that was going to be satisfying in a way that a lot of the parts that I had been asked to do out here had not been. But I didn't have any expectation with how it was going to be received or what it was going to turn out to be. It was the first time for a lot of us on that set. It was Jill Soloway, directed it and wrote it. And, it was Juno Temple and Josh Radner. A lot of people. Keegan was so awesome in it. Michael Key.
Always
great. So
yeah.
Good. Michaela Watkins. It was like an awesome group of people. This guy, Jimmy Frohna, was the DP who was incredible. And he went on to do all of Transparent. He just did Big Little Lies this last season. And he's an incredible DP. And so, yeah, it ended up being like an amazing group of people that he also did I Love Dick. But yeah, it was like a 3-week shoot. We ended up, like, they rented a car for me. They couldn't get the camera equipment in it, so we ended up using my minivan. Like, so it ended up just being like this amazing, just like this, the holiest of experiences. And then it just kind of like set a weird new bar for myself that I just had not had that out here at all. Like, I just kind of had all this theater, had all this like churning feeling of pleasure of working for like no money until I was 30 something, and then came out here and had a new experience, which was making money but not really feeling that same feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it was starting to wed together at a time in my life, almost 40, that I was like, oh, well, this can happen like this. I had thought that the opposite would happen. Like, I had no idea that that was going to be that it could be wedded together. So that was like a very happy surprise.
I didn't really know that you were thinking you were going to be a theater actor, because that's Nick and I both had that same thing. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Northwestern undergrad.
Oh yeah, me too.
Did we not know this?
I guess not. We don't do any research, and that's becoming apparent.
No, I can't believe that I didn't know this about you.
I went for two. I only went for 2 years. I didn't, because I started doing theater in Chicago, so I didn't go back. You know, I tried to go back my junior year, but it was a little too much. So I'm a college dropout, but yeah, I Northwestern.
Well, yeah, because you're such a goddamn stud. You just went into right into working. I had nothing. I was just like eternal student. I went to Northwestern. That's where I met Ethan, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, we've been together forever, forever and ever. But yeah, I went to Northwestern, and then when we moved to New York, I was there for a while, and then I went to Yale. But I went to Yale Drama School, and I was like later. I was like 27 when I went. And then did theater, but like, you know, off Broadway. But then I did like 7 years of Williamstown Theater Festival, which was the dreamiest, but like started as a non-ec, or, you know, started there in their experimental, and then as a non-ec where they kind of like hand you a Makita and some sugar and have you tear down sets at 3 a.m. And then, but I worked with some amazing playwrights and, that was the best. And then they turned to me Equity. And then I kind of continued that while I was at Yale at Williamstown. So Williamstown
was
really
fun. When was the last time you did a play?
It was Boeing, which was like a...
Oh, we saw that. Yeah, you were great in that.
When, I loved
what year
it.
Was that?
That was
2008?
A long time ago now. Too long ago.
2008, was, probably, right?
Yeah.
Because that's when I was doing Young Frankenstein, I think. Yeah.
Oh, with... Chris Fitzgerald, and, who I haven't seen in a billion
years. And you guys had a show maybe on a Sunday night or a Monday because we were able to see.
To see it.
You was one of the few, or maybe you did your, you know, I don't know.
Oh, right. Shows, the special shows for the other actors.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I loved that experience. So that was, it was, I had a, Leonard, our son, was about not even a year. So that made it, I thought it was going to be an easier gig than it was, but it was,
They're never, 8 shows a week is never easy.
It was, and Young Frankenstein was a long time, was a long run too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I did it for, I don't know, altogether, it was over a year and a half or something like that. But I think I only did it, you know, we were out of town for a long time. So we rehearsed it in New York and then we did it in Seattle for 2 months. So yeah, but and then we did it. I think I did it on Broadway for like a year, and
yeah,
it was fun.
That was the only show I did on. That was the only show I did on Broadway. I'd love to go back, but
how can we describe what it's like doing 8 shows a week to people who aren't in the performing arts? Like, what would you compare it to? Like being on an assembly line or something.
I know. Well, what's crazy is you think like people think like, oh, once you're up, then it's only a few hours of your day, but it's not.
Because, no, like, it's your whole life.
It's your whole life because like once it's about 3 o'clock, your engine just turns towards it. And mm-hmm. then you just can't stop thinking like that. Your whole heart, your whole, like basically your solar plexus is just like your inner compass is just like, towards the stage. Like you can't think about anything else. Like you're just basically there. So
yeah.
You can't focus on anything else. And then once you're done, you can't get to bed before 2 a.m. Like it's great. You're after the show wraps, your adrenaline is just like racing towards.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're burning an engine that's not calibrated to put out like an 8 hour work day or a 10 hour work day. It's calibrated to burn 2 very hot hours. And so, like you say, you start stoking it. If you can't go out and do something, you can't go on a hike in the morning because when you then go to fight rehearsal at 6 p.m., you're like, oh man, I really feel that I burned that energy this morning. That was a mistake.
It's almost easier just to keep going. Like the 2 show days are almost easier because if you have a Sunday matinee, then you don't have another show till Tuesday night. And you think, oh, great. I have like, you know, almost 2 whole days off. Well, then you're in a panic on all day Tuesday thinking, oh, no, I can't do it. I can't get my energy. You know, how did I do that just
exactly.
on Sunday? And some people, I mean, not very many. Most people, when they're doing a show, go out every night after the show and stay up really late, sleep really late. I've only known one person, Andrea Martin, who was in Young Frankenstein.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, she's so great. And she's the only person I've ever known out of all the shows I've done that was, she would go right home and go to bed. She'd be asleep by like 11:30. I don't know how you could possibly do that. I don't even understand it.
Yeah, and she's
get
just
up
a
early,
creature.
Go to the gym. Yeah. But yeah, I don't, I know it's a tricky, and if it's a musical, which most of the shows I've done on Broadway have been musicals, or most of the, not all, but I mean, it's like more than half of the shows I've done in theater have been musicals, probably like 70%. And so then there's that whole other added component of like, you know, oh my God, is it still there? Can I sing? Am I warmed up? Like, am I getting, God forbid you're getting a cold or something, because you can work through a cold in a play, but if it's a musical, that there's a chance you might have to miss shows.
Oh, I would love to see you do a musical.
Oh, that's nice.
There's nothing like it.
I can't imagine. I want to see it. So I do you have any plans in the future? I saw you do your live show with, oh, God damn it, my brain. When you did it, oh,
Seth
that
Rudetsky?
Beautiful. Yes. No, wait, no, wait, the woman, is that her name?
No, Nancy and Beth, the band.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Oh, and that was so fucking extraordinary, the two of you guys. I saw it at Largo.
Yeah, I think you came on that infamous night when we invited a lot of people to come and they actually came, and it was like our worst show we ever had. Irony, a vast irony. Well, that's
I don't know. I beg to differ on that, but
that's very nice. There's this original musical that it's called Hooray for Ice Boy that there was just a workshop of it that I did, and Nick was actually in it too. We just did it. It's like the last thing we did before we all got quarantined. And it's something I really want to do. It's a really crazy, weird, funny. It's some of the people who wrote that show Urinetown, which was a great Broadway show.
Yeah.
Really kind of meta. It's by those people and some people who worked on Spelling Bee, which is another great Broadway show.
Yeah.
So that's something that I really, really want to do. And it's a great part. And the thing that I've never gotten to do is a really, really great part. I've gotten to do good parts, but not great parts. That would really show everything.
Fingers crossed. Okay.
Me too. It's so hard to get stuff done.
I know. Yeah.
Trying to get it. Get somebody to produce.
You know
it.
That you can live stream now too, like a lot of like the I mean, I'm sure you know this, but I guess like Lincoln Center, like there's a lot of, and the Met, I think, I mean, I haven't done any of this, but I guess you can live stream like the opera has like a bunch of like all their archival musicals. There's like a, anyway, just in inspiration. I was thinking about doing it for the kids too, but I guess there's a lot of like archival musicals or things like that. Or the
all the Broadway shows I've done have been archived. I think it's Lincoln
I'm sure
Center.
That I could see them then through that, which would be fantastic.
Yeah, I don't think they archived for some weird reason. I think I remember somebody saying that. They didn't archive this production of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying that I did back in the, it was like 1995.
Oh, yeah, with Broderick.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
that was like an iconic
Yeah, he won the show. Tony for that. It was a really good production. But I don't think they archived that for some weird reason. I don't remember why. But, or maybe they did. I don't know. Anyway, it would be nice to go back and see some of those things.
Yeah.
Matthew probably has it on video cassette and he's holding out.
Probably. I have bootleg audio tapes of it. Somebody sent me. So much fun. That's so cool though. I didn't really realize you were a theater actor.
A bunch of theater kids, which by the way, not to buzz market, but earlier Catherine dropped a little slang. And for those of you that are not in the habit of building theater scenery in the 1980s and 90s, a Makita, the first big cordless drill that hit the scene was an enormous aqua blue Makita, 9.6 volt.
I wondered what you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Is that not on the scene anymore? Did I just drop something from the early
Well,
from the early
Makita? Like Makita was the, was ubiquitous. Like Makita was the Kleenex of or the Q-tips of,
sure,
of cordless
sure, sure.
drills.
But, sure.
But now there's DeWalt and Milwaukee and there's Porter Cable. There are several brands.
Sure, sure.
That have,
oh, but the Makita, that was the classic.
Yeah.
Set building tool.
It was, and it was the most. Nothing has been more pistol like. You right. had it in a holster on your belt. It was
yeah.
It's pretty
right.
badass.
It was like a bright turquoise. It was like a turquoise, like a blue, right?
That's right.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, it was turquoise.
Our Makita. Yeah, exactly. We built all
that.
The sets.
That's
all
so
the
fine.
Sets for all the plays. Even back at Northwestern, I feel like we did. I was like, that was my job at Northwestern, though, that I was like, because, you know, we did, I had to do for my, I guess, because I was all on loans and, like, you know, I had to have like a student, like, I had to have a job. Of course, because I was all, it was all like loans and scholarships and yada yada. So I had to get a job at the prop shop. That was my job. So I was like in the props department at Northwestern. That was like great, crazy, haunted place up those little stairs.
I know it well. I used to build
yes.
Props for a guy named Ed Bevin in that prop shop.
Yes. I feel like that rings a bell.
Yeah, he was Steppenwolf's prop guy, and then he became full time at Northwestern. So in the mid '90s, when I was there, I was building scenery.
I fucking love props. I love props. I love Nick handling Spiltz. Them. I just love the whole.
Nick built some pretty crazy props in his day.
In case the acting thing didn't work out, I was known as. The unique prop builder.
Wait, did you have other jobs?
I was a reception. Well, I was a receptionist at a hair salon. My cousin got me the job when I first moved to New York, and that was a very fancy hair salon. It was called Garin, New York.
Oh my
and
gosh!
It was.
It sounds like a sketch.
Yeah. It was totally. I had my one Banana Republic suit that was shiny on the shoulders because I had dry cleaned it so many times. It was like black. That was the only one I had. It was basically totally shiny because I had to dry clean it so many times. I once walked in and Garen was like, honey. And I looked down and I had drooled toothpaste down my boob. Like when I walked like in the morning, because I didn't realize I was, all the guys who worked there got together one Christmas and bought me a Mason Pearson hairbrush. Cause they were like, you gotta brush your hair. Cause I like still, even back then, like was like, had never ever dealt with my hair. It was like $85 blow dries back then, which was insanity. This was in 95. I mean, it's still insanity. I mean, it was like, I couldn't wrap my mind around somebody paying. I just was like, what are you? And this was like on the weekly, like women had like standing appointments to blow dry their hair. I'm like, I came from Ohio. Like, I was like, what the fuck is happening? Pardon my French. Like, this was a world that I knew nothing about. And they would get cappuccinos sent up from, it was at Henry Bendel, and people would get their cappuccinos sent up like, to have with getting their blow dry. I was like, what is happening? And there was a Mac counter and there was a guy, one of the guys that would help with like one of the assistants. We were always trying to find him and he was always inevitably up at the manicure station painting his toenails vamp. Do you remember that color vamp?
Chanel yes, vamp? Of course.
At some point, Garen, he wanted to do something with my hair. So it was back when they were doing those like big chunky Anne Bancroft skunk stripes in the front of your hair.
Oh
so
my
he totally
God.
Did these like big chunky white like Anne Bancroft graduate skunk stripes in the front of my hair. And Ethan and I were living in a one room studio apartment on East 61st between 1st and 2nd. And you looked out your window and you saw Scores. Do you remember Scores? It was like an old, well.
Strip club.
Yes, thank you. Nick's like, what are you talking about? I have no idea what you could possibly.
I've read of such things.
But but you could see scores from our window, and you could also see the 59th Street Bridge.
Wait, what street were you on?
On East 61st.
Oh, okay.
First yeah. and second. Uh-huh. And this is such a tangent, but I'll get back to the skunk stripes, but I remember that when we first got this apartment, it was the first time we'd lived together after Northwestern. We had to put our albums together for the first time. And while we put our records together, he had, what's the song? We didn't know that the song was called the 59th Street Bridge song.
Feeling Groovy.
Yes! So we couldn't believe it that was actually the... Anyway, it was very tender, sweet, our cute. First moving together. But anyway, so he woke up to me in this one-room studio to me basically like bawling because it was so stressful trying to make our $600 a month rent. And I had my Mason Pearson hairbrush and it was stuck in my fucking hair because I was trying to do my freaking Anne Bancroft hair to go into work at this goddamn hair salon that I hated so fucking much. All I wanted to do was act and I couldn't find a goddamn job. And I was trying to make my hair work. And he looked at me like I was basically trying. The only mirror was above our kitchen sink that was wedged between a shower and our door. Like we had no, like, you know what I mean? It was like one of those apartments where like you open the front door and you hit the shower. Like it was like, everything's falling apart. He like woke up to me just like with the hairbrush, which was like the most expensive thing I owned. Basically, it was like a $90 hairbrush. Twisted into my skunk stripe. Anyway, those were the days, guys. Those were the days.
That's so funny though, because when I was doing a show in New York at that time, I was doing How to Succeed, and you know, it was the first time that I had, well, not, I mean, not really, but it was a time when I was, you know, making money every week, and so yeah. Somebody told me about this fancy salon. It wasn't your salon. I wish it had been, but it was, his name was Edward something. And that was the name of the salon. And it was on the East Upper East Side, of course. And for some reason he cut my hair himself. I'm not sure how that could be, but he did this crazy thing where he would trim your hair and it was incredibly terrifying. After, when he was done trimming your hair, then the pièce de résistance was he would take his scissors and he would go in a circle really fast around you, like two or three times with the scissors just going like this on your hair, just
oh my God.
Cutting. I mean, it was so scary. And I don't know. I'm lucky that I wasn't, you know, maimed.
Was it Edward Scissorhands?
I mean, but seriously, like, I keep thinking that maybe Tim Burton, like, went or heard about somebody going
honestly
to that salon and like literally made the movie. But I think the movie was before that, actually. Or one of them got the idea from the other one, I'm sure. But
that's amazing.
It was scary.
That's terrifying. This guy, Garen, though, ended up being like, he was such, they all were like, so my anti-mames when I first came to that city, though. They were took such good care of me. Like, I was such soft spots for that salon experience. And when I got into Yale, because I was working there at the time, and I couldn't fucking believe it. And again, like, it was all on, like, well, you know, I mean, I had so much fucking debt. I'm so sorry I'm swearing so much, guys.
We're swearing so offended.
Please don't tell my parents. But I had so much debt, but they were so excited for me. It was like my little, like, you know, makeshift New York family. Like they were so excited because they had seen me. I mean, you know, I was doing these plays that were like off. So not so off Broadway that you were like, you have, not only will you have to find 12 people to buy tickets if you want to do the play. Like, it was like a scam.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To do theater. Like, it was like, totally. I was so crazy there. But I just was so desperate that they were, anyway, they took really good care.
That's
but I
so
mean,
nice.
that was like until I was 27. Like, it, so shit didn't really start happening for me and for a long time. I mean, it's so weird, the course of events. Like, nothing really happened for me until I was, you know, later.
Yeah.
So I just, like, it's so, you know, who could have thunk it?
Well, I find that really inspiring. Because I remember when
Nick's
I
was still waiting for his big break.
Yeah, so I mean, inspired. One day, if it happens, maybe I should look for a salon to work in.
Yeah.
But the idea that, you know, that there's no one right or wrong way. There's no clear path. It's so different for everybody's different context. And I just remember when I was a young actor, I would the most successful actor from my area, the Chicagoland area, was John Cusack. So for years, I would just be very aware of what he was doing and how I wasn't keeping up with him. Where I was like, God damn it, Cusack did another three this year, and I don't have my SAG card yet. And then eventually that became too depressing. But then William H. Macy did Fargo, and he was like 43 or something when he sort of had his big break. And I was like, oh, you can, everybody, it's different for everybody. So then I was like, all I got to do is get to 43.
Totally.
You never know. It could.
But, you know, but in anything, in any, you know, profession or in relationships. I mean, I was 41 when I met Nick, and that was my big break.
Boom.
Oh, God damn it. Boom.
It's true. You know, because people get panicky.
Yeah. Don't panic.
It's not always going to. You know, you're not going to be at the top of your field when you're 23 years old. Very few people are in whatever profession. And then sometimes a lot of the time, I think people who get too much success too soon kind of flame out.
And I also think that there's such, you know, which is what I'm finding more interesting the older I get, which I also didn't expect this to happen, is that I feel like it's like the juiciest, most creative like time has been since I've been in my mid 40s. Like, it's very strange, and also what the world had been telling me to expect the opposite of. Like, I am finding I'm rejecting that, and it's also just becoming, because I'm rejecting that, it's just becoming more and more the truth that it's not the case. Yeah. Like, I'm finding it the most inspired chapter of my life.
I agree.
And also, I think it's because I think I wasn't ready to meet these parts when I was in my 20s. I feel like I wasn't, I think I was definitely in my own way. I think I didn't have the confidence for so many reasons. I feel like I was almost acting the part of an actor in my 20s, if that makes sense. I think I was trying to be something that I just wasn't, instead of just, especially out here. I don't know what that means. I just feel like my fullest self was when I was in theater. And so I feel like it took me a long time to get to back to that place in this medium.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been like a real revelation that it's just taken a second to get to.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh right, that feeling is the feeling. Like, I don't have to pretend that this shouldn't be always the feeling. Like, it does. Like, why do I have to save that for my scrappy ensemble?
Yeah. Totally.
You know, like, that should always, like, that isn't like this precious thing that I just have on a stage. That should always be the feeling when I'm making something. It's so weird.
But I'm kind of looking for what you're talking about, because I haven't been able to break out of just playing gigantic comedy characters, like really over the top comedy characters. Like, I very, very, very rarely have had the chance to do anything even remotely like a real person, or that has more, you know, of a settled dynamic. But I'm trying to figure out what my purpose is creatively now, you know, because maybe it's just to stay home and read books and, you know, not be in the public eye anymore. I don't really know. I'm really up in the air about it, and I'm totally fine with whatever it turns out to be.
Simmer and see just like what rises.
Yeah.
Maybe you write it yourself. Maybe. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Or not, you know?
Or not. Exactly.
That's almost.
Like, who knows what will, like, what's around whatever creative corner.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because I feel like it's something that I haven't really necessarily articulated, but there's almost a taboo around just stopping and being okay with it. Like,
yeah,
I think especially with performers, I think that people think, because it seems like it's proven true in most cases, that if you're an actor or a musician or whatever, that you are going to be doing it until you're 95 years old and you're like, I got to get that next part. I got to make another album, you know, all of that stuff. And you're going to talk like that. And it's just not true.
No.
It's not true for me, but I feel like I don't know if I ever necessarily really wanted to be an actor. I just kind of stumbled into it because I'm more of a singer, and my singing got me into, in order to, yeah. So it's kind of a weird thing now that I, like, certain things have transpired and changed my feelings about things. And now I'm just like, oh, well, you know, I could also just sit in nature and, you know.
Oh, well, you're a goddess of whatever you choose to do. And you are absolutely right. You don't have to, there, it's your path. And like, you just see what rises. Like, you're absolutely right. If it doesn't have, who cares? It's your path. You take a second, whatever you decide.
Yeah. I mean, I think that everybody on the planet wants to exercise their creativity in whatever way they can, you know, not in the arts. I mean, in any profession or lack thereof, you want to feel like you're creating. And so
what you're doing right now. I mean, this is awesome that you guys are doing this. Like, this is,
yeah.
I mean, this podcast is look, who would have thunk that this would have been happening? Like, this is a new.
I know.
Well, it's nice. A very good point, though, that to the outside, especially I think in show business, in our culture of consumerism and capitalism, people assume that if we're not, let's say you do a hit TV series for 10 years and then you do a couple movies and then you're lucky enough to do a really good streaming series for 4 years, then maybe you're like, wow, that was really lucky. That was a really lucky 16 years of work. I think it'll be hard to find something as fulfilling as that 16 years. So my creativity turns to something that's not in the public eye, that's not going to get me in a magazine. Maybe it's taking care of family members. Well, maybe it's gardening.
Money has a lot to do with this too, because I think that people have a hard time understanding that you wouldn't want to continue to do the thing that you've been the most successful at making money at.
Right.
You know? And to say, oh, I don't want to make that much money anymore. I mean, that's not what I'm saying, but that's part of it.
It is,
because there are very few professions that are going to pay, like, say, what Will and Grace just paid.
Yeah.
Just doesn't happen.
You get one of those winning lottery tickets, like a network sitcom that's amazing, like Will and Grace. And that opens up your options then.
Do you feel like, are you talking about, because I hear you, like, about the cultural stigma that we have of somebody being able to say, like, in this culture of, like, do.
Yeah, and be famous. Be famous, be famous.
Right.
Yeah.
I totally hear you.
I don't care about being famous at all. I never did.
Yeah.
And I don't like the culture around.
Yeah, no, me either.
Fame.
Yeah,
you, of course not. You know, none of our friends, I mean, we're all like-minded in that regard. You know, none of us are in it for that reason. And that whole thing is all fake anyway. The whole concept of Hollywood is just a man-made construct. It doesn't even exist. You know, it's jobs.
It's
just
a
like
real
any other
Hollywood
job.
Sign, though. I've seen it.
That is the most real thing about Hollywood is the Hollywood sign. I can we can say that with certainty.
But this
that is so true.
I have seen that sign.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Save big money on your next project with help from Menards. Move water where you need it quickly with a Barracuda sump pump. Sump pumps keep your basement dry when big storms hit unexpectedly. Get a half horsepower cast iron Barracuda sump pump on sale now through May 5th. Hurry into Menards. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
So speaking of, this is maybe a good opportunity to ask you about looking around other creative opportunities. Don't you have a children's book that that you're prepared to talk about?
I love you. I did have a children's book that came out. It was a few years ago, but yes, I do. I would love to talk about it now.
Okay, I want to talk about the fact that so this podcast, the way we do it is we ask the guests if there's a certain topic that they want to discuss, like, you know, health or automobiles or, you know, I don't know, anything. And what we got back from probably not you, I'm now guessing, is that you desperately wanted to talk about your children's book. Please do not cut this out if anyone's going to edit this down because I love this so much. Maybe. So I was like, wow, that doesn't sound like Catherine.
Can
to
we
me
get the rights to the song?
She really is,
operator.
She's given us specific instructions that she wants the entire episode to be about her children's book. Like, that just doesn't sound like Catherine Hahn. So we brought it up and then you were just looking at us like, what the fuck are you guys talking about? And we were in the middle of this really philosophical discussion.
I did have a children's book and I'm very proud of it. It came out a couple of years ago and it is adorable.
What's it called?
It's called My Wish for You.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I kind of co-wrote it with my daughter and it's really, really, really sweet. Yeah. It came out a couple of years ago. I think that's why I was surprised.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that we... got that out of our systems.
But I am very proud of it. It's really sweet.
I like your kids. Your kids have great names, May and Leonard.
Yeah.
Those are such good names.
They're good eggs. They really are.
Did you always want to have kids or?
I was kind of like, I just was one of those things that I figured would happen, but it wasn't like I was dying to or was like I couldn't wait to hold one. I was like never one of those kids that was like I couldn't wait to be a mom.
Mm-hmm.
What if I just pan and my daughter's just like sitting right here
covered in her own feces?
No, but I certainly now is like, it's, you know, I can't imagine it not. And they've been, I mean, it's been, they're amazing. Like I can't imagine these humans not existing.
That's
for sure.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
I never had that, you know, burning desire, but I think I didn't think about it that much when I was younger. And then as I got older and was in relationships and, you know, having sex, and suddenly realized that I could actually become pregnant. And then I realized that I desperately did not want to become pregnant. And I don't know what that means or why, but that's just, you know, the way it is.
Yeah.
That's nature.
No, I mean, it's, yeah, exactly. It was not, I mean, and it's, I have plenty of pals that don't, and plenty of pals that are trying, plenty of pals that are, you know, it's in this particular family, we were like, it's two. And then there was like, I had a mourning period afterwards. If I'm like, oh, I guess we're done. And, you know, I was called a geriatric mother when I got pregnant at 35, which was like, wow. You know, and I had done this movie called Private Life. And that was about a couple going through IVF, which kind of opened my eyes up to a whole world that I had no idea about. That and just what a bill of goods were sold in terms of, you know, a woman's reproductive timeline. And
yeah,
it's kind of intense. It's just like, it is a real biological bummer that we're our chief kind of money making or career years happen to coincide with our most fertile. It's just a bummer.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying that everybody's the party line is like, don't worry, women are having babies in their 40s, right?
Yeah, and it's actually not that easy.
Yeah. I mean, women do have babies in their 40s, but it's rare. Yeah.
Of course. Mm-hmm. But the IVF, I guess, or those kind of things, or the freezing of the eggs, all these things that women are doing are actually not maybe as easy as it seems.
No. I think they're very hard, and then
costly, but also very costly,
really expensive, really hard on you emotionally, costly. Mentally, physically, but then also potentially really dangerous. I think the jury is still out as to whether or not that kind of stuff is a carcinogen. You know, I don't think people really know.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway,
I've never heard like a great IVF story.
Yeah. I've heard people having, but yes, the experience doesn't sound really joyful.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you, would you, because if not, we can just cut this part out, but would you feel comfortable talking about what we talked about for a long time at that party when I saw you, about your capacity to do love scenes?
Sure.
Okay, good. Okay, so let me just set it up by saying that...
just let me have a quick sip of my Pimm's cup.
Yeah, girl.
No, it's my iced tea.
Catherine has done a lot of movies where she's had to do sex scenes, for lack of a better word. And I really admire your ability to do that because you're so, I don't know, I just feel like, I think I asked you, I was like, how do you do that without, you know, feeling self-conscious and, or I don't know, freaking out. I mean, if I knew I had anything like that coming up, which I never will now because I'm 61, but even back in the day, I think I would have like freaked out about it to the point where I wouldn't have been able to function on the day. And you said you don't even think about it. To you, it's just another scene like any other. So how do you?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, a couple things. First, I would say that I've been in regular, like, smooching scenes in network shows that have felt more uncomfortable than some of the I guess, like, sex scenes that I've been asked to do in some of these other shows. Because the gaze feels different. It's like you're just being looked at through, like, a different sort of, like, and it doesn't feel as... It just doesn't feel as safe or comfortable because you're being asked, like,
they're trying to sell something.
They're trying to sell something. You're just being, you know, there's a spray tan gun, you know, held at you, and they're the chicken cutlets, and that, you know, someone is trying to like do something to you that you already don't feel like you're looking like something that they are wanting you to look like, or you're just trying to be, you know, you see all the lights set up and you're like, oh brother. So you already don't feel like you can really like be lost.
Mm-hmm.
Just do your job.
Mm-hmm.
So that's A. So B, when it comes to the work that you're talking about with, I guess these last two shows, especially, I would say like in this last show I did Mrs. Fletcher. I'll just say for that, I'll just talk about that show. That show was the first time I had worked with someone called an intimacy coordinator.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that until you said it. And then recently we were watching High Maintenance and there was a character whose job is to be an intimacy coordinator. Yeah.
Yeah, they do an episode about an intimacy coach who's like a fight choreographer.
Who meets a guy.
Yeah, it's like a fight choreographer.
Yeah. She meets a guy who's asexual.
That's amazing. I've not seen that show yet, by the way.
It's so good. It's good.
And I would say the same thing on I Love Dick too. Like even though both shows were not all written before I had signed on, I signed on with, of course, complete clarity, and transparency of knowing exactly what I was walking into and, knowing what to expect and knowing like the nudity and knowing all that. So it's not like I was blindsided by anything walking in. And also knowing it was very important to me that in both circumstances, they were going to be directed all by women. Except for I Love Dick, one episode was directed by Jimmy Frohna, who is our DP of all the other episodes. So we had talked about him before also. So high degree of trust. And that doesn't always have to be the case, but it was important for me that I knew it. And yeah. So in the case of Mrs. Fletcher, you know, it's like always, it's like you just want to feel like you have that you're in control in those scenes and that your scene partner is also like, so that the idea of the closed set is really valuable. You're just like the least amount of people in the room, and that the thing I liked about this intimacy coordinator part, although the title is hilarious, but that you know that your scene partner has been talked to ahead of time as well, so that when you walk in together on the day, you know that you are both, the parameters have been set, so that you're
great.
Not questioning his or her doubts or nerves. So mm-hmm. that you know that you're both like, there's no like you know that you're not like, is this okay? Like everybody knows the terms,
mm-hmm.
so that you can just like get down to the business like so much faster. It just feels like there's somebody there that's both of your advocates at the same time. That's not the director, because so that the director doesn't have to worry about doing that as well. So, and that person is also your advocate and the director's advocate. Like it's another person in the room that is looking out. That's like over the whole thing, looking out for everybody's safety in a way that I was like, oh, this is a job that should always have existed. Like, honestly,
well, isn't it?
It just made
it's,
so much sense to
it's
me.
It's ironic. Well, ironic isn't even the right term. It's sad. But somehow not surprising that this job didn't come about, I don't think, until the whole like Me Too, Harvey Weinstein movement.
No, because exactly.
Because they didn't have to do it. See?
Right.
They didn't have to do it. So they didn't do it. But they should have done it all along.
Well, I mean, I'll say like, you know, usually like before it had been my, like in for I Love Dick, we didn't have it. And I felt, again, like, I had felt very completely safe in that regard, because I'd always approached those scenes. I love my scene partners in that. Like there was complete trust there. Again, it was like a stripped down room. That room is like a family. Like I should like not, you know, not like a, but it felt very safe. Like I knew that who was behind the monitor, it was closed set. I and my scene partner had a say, final word as to who was allowed in the room. My wardrobe person was kind of also my she kind of also functioned as an intimacy coordinator, weirdly, and that, you know, like she was there always with the robe. Mm-hmm. So she's the, she was the there person to be like always, right there, basically mm-hmm. in the corner of the room.
Yeah.
Blair Witch style. And then it's like, it just functions like, again, it really did feel like any other scene in the day. Like, it just feels like if you put any other onus or any other time on it, it just, if you drag it out any longer, then it becomes like, you just want to make sure it is just like a scene in the day.
Yeah. Like, see, that's the thing about your thinking about it that I was so interested in, is that you think of it in that way. You don't put any importance on it outside of just being part of the job that you need to get done.
Yeah, it shouldn't be any more than that. It's a part of the story that's being told, and it's just it's a scene in the day. It mm-hmm. would be hard. It would be very strange if there was more onus on any of those scenes. In my humble opinion, it should just be a scene in the day.
Mm-hmm. And that's great. I love that. I love that you can think about it in that way. And I think it's very powerful. I don't know if most women can think of it in that way. I'm not sure. Maybe they all do. I don't know. But I think you might be in the minority. I'm not sure.
Maybe. I mean, they were very important to the stories that I agreed and wanted to tell. And again, it was very powerful for me. And I'll just use those two as examples in I Love Dick and in Mrs. Fletcher, in that they both were kind of, in my mind, were flipping the idea of female pleasure inside out of the gay, on the gaze, on how we were able to look at it. It did felt very feminine for me, the gaze. So it didn't feel like it was,
No, it's coming from like a feminist standpoint, basically, those roles. And you're also working, and you're also working on pretty cool projects with cool people, smart people. You're not talking about a network show or some big freaking studio movie, $100 million shit show. You know, you're working on cool projects to begin with, which helps.
Well, it was exploring to me an interesting chapter in a woman's life and women's lives that have historically been a time of invisibility. And so I was excited about, shining a light on that. And then I don't think, I don't think politically when I take jobs. Like I thought that they were just juicy and interesting and complicated parts. But like I also knew that going into it, the gaze was not going to be aggro or male on it.
Mm-hmm.
We were just going to be going on from the inside. Not that that's like, not that that's like the only barometer, but for those particular projects, it was interesting for me to explore going inside a woman's experience mm-hmm. of, in the case of I Love Dick, just a obsession and desire and creative, just like creative explosion. And for Mrs. Fletcher, just pleasure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Finding herself.
Yeah. It's so cool. And obsession is such a cool subject to explore too, I think. Mm-hmm.
I find it, as the guy in this conversation, I also find it just as inspiring. Because it's true across the board. The way our society has had this male point of view, and it's funny. It is really relatable to fight choreography in that, which is something I used to do in the theater a lot. And it's whether you're dealing with men and women, and whether it's rapiers and daggers or lovemaking, it's a sensibility of treating everybody with an equal amount of respect, making everyone feel safe and recognized. And so what you say is certainly true. Like, we've got a long way to go to recognize all the times and all the ways in which all of the others, including women or minorities or, you know, sexes besides straight men, are recognized. And, you know, the stories are about everybody but white guys. We got a long way to go before we've evened the tally on that score. But even as a straight white guy, I also want, like, I want to advocate for that because it, A, because it's fair to all of the minorities in every way. But also, I'm a dumb, clumsy human. Like, I need an intimacy coordinator. I, just like anybody, I had more fight scenes where you would get some macho dude basically saying the equivalent, some version of, oh, just take a punch. Like, you know, don't be a wuss.
Oh, God.
Just, yeah. Like, just take it, or just, you know, just grab her by the hair. Like, you know, and you're, and, you know, I'm very interested in, like, destroying that sensibility that, like, that there's anything remotely respectable or decent about that. It's shameful,
yeah, right,
and misogynistic and old fashioned. So I'm as thrilled as anybody to hear this great point of view that you're putting forth.
Well, you're an incredible, awesome human being, Nick Offerman.
Yeah, it's true.
Gentleman, and one of the best ones we have. So that's no surprise to me.
Yeah.
Well,
but you're so right about the fight, because that's what it does too. It's like you just also just want to know that someone is there to be like, this is what it looks like on camera. This is what I mean, just like it's for practical, you know, just practical purposes too, for any and all genders. And you're right. You're so right about just, it's just about having just different, I mean, I was just talking about those two projects, but you're right. It's just for any, seems to be a great time for any, for all sorts of perspectives. Just like when that word gaze is so weird in terms of just like,
yeah, it's pretty fraught.
But it is so great to turn on this, just to turn on the TV and start streaming stuff and just like see things now through so many other lenses. Maybe lenses is a better word. Just like, I feel lucky that my kids are able to like, to see things through so many other lenses right now. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I just saw this documentary called Honeyland.
Oh, that was our favorite.
We love it so much. It was our favorite.
Oh,
our favorite.
So good.
That's interesting, because my next question to you is going to be, what kinds of movies and television shows do you really love the most? That was my next question.
Oh my God. Well, that we just like blew my mind,
yeah,
because I could not, I was like, the access and the intimacy they had with those, that woman, like, couldn't believe we were at that.
It's unforgettable.
Woman, mother's death.
Yeah, we saw that movie back, I don't know, like
a couple months ago.
A little more than that, even, like maybe November, December. And it's vivid in my mind.
Oh, me too. Can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
I had the kids see it because I was like, you're not, they're so bored thinking about it. And I was like, you guys are not going to believe it.
It's nothing
it's like
that
world
any of us have ever, yeah, it's nothing that any of us have ever seen before. Yes, it's so
ever.
Simple. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just couldn't believe that. And she's so relatable. I was like, I felt like I'd known her my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I want to be friends with her. Like, I just loved her so much. Anyway, that really blew my mind.
What else are you?
I've been watching a lot of old ones. I mean, we just finished Tiger King. I don't know if you guys have seen
we
it.
We did too.
It was a real great escape.
Yeah.
It was a real great escape. I don't know. I've been seeing a lot of, like, we've been seeing a ton of older movies over here. Like, we just saw that I hadn't seen in a million years. We just saw The Big Lebowski again. Mm. And we just saw There Will Be Blood again. Mm. Like, we're just trying to do a lot of, like, first time watching with these guys, trying to do a little movie camp sitch. We saw, I tried to show him The Exorcist and he fell asleep within like 30 minutes.
That's interesting.
And I was like, this is my fucking Exorcist. This changed my life when I was 13 years old. Like, it blew my mind, scarred me, scared the shit out of me. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I was like, he's like, I want to see a scary movie. And I was like, okay, should not be doing this, but this is going to. And
it's, he was pretty
softly
tame,
snoring
though, now,
while she was
right?
like, fuck me, fuck me. He was asleep. And I was like, well, thank God. But he was like asleep. That scene started happening. I was like, oh no. Oh my God. And then I turned over and he was softly snoring.
Oh, I love it.
1973.
Well, what are some of your other favorite, like all time favorites?
I mean, all time favorites. I mean, okay. This is what's going to come to my head. Fleabag, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Woman Under the Influence.
Mm.
I was just thinking about this, the Red, White, and Blue series, just French, Camille Claudel. I was talking about that with my friend recently. It's a French series.
Yeah, I've seen those. Yeah, long time ago.
Uh-huh. Long, long time. Oh, this long, long. These are all like high school ones for some reason that are like popping back up now. I also love. What else do are all-time favorites? I mean, the David Lynch ones.
Mm-hmm.
I loved E.T.
Mm. Yeah.
I love E.T. so much. Can't stand it. The soundtrack, everything. It's like an opera. It's like so perfect to me as a movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think everybody, the world is going to be abuzz about your children's book after this podcast. Yeah. So
it's
I
really
hope that you're happy.
And I'm really glad that
wow, what an agenda this one has.
Wait, but I do have this. I mean, do I like say what I've got coming out?
Yes.
Can I do that?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Yes.
That's how it's done.
I mean, I have a show on a mini series on HBO coming out called I Know This Much Is True,
ooh,
which I think is going to be great.
Yay. Wait, I feel like I read
and
that book. Is that a book?
It's a Wally Lamb book.
Yeah, I read that book. Oh, that's so great.
It's beautiful, and it's Mark Ruffalo is starring as the twins, and it's directed by Derek Cianfrance, who's the amazing director of Blue Valentine.
Oh, wow.
And I think it's, and so Mark is playing twins, and it's pretty incredible. So that's coming out,
wow.
I'm not exactly sure of the day, but soon.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's based on the Kajagoogoo song?
Okay.
It's based on the Kajagoogoo song.
Oh, God, that sounds good.
What else?
Exactly. And then there is a show called Central Park.
Oh, the animated show. Yeah, that's our friends.
The animated show.
Yeah, because I do a recurring, I'm Aunt Gail on Bob's Burgers, and then we're both on this show called The Great North. It's a new show for Fox that two of the Bob's writers have spun off. Yeah.
Oh, fabulous.
I know.
Yeah. So that's
isn't Lauren Bouchard the nicest person in the world?
I love him. Yeah.
How fun.
All around.
His, every time I've ever gone to record an episode of that show, it's been so fun.
And he just has it down to such a science.
Yeah.
He knows exactly what he wants. He's just, good, decent people.
Yeah.
So yeah, that and my children's book, guys.
Oh, man. It's a lot.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
My wish.
Well,
for you.
I watch everything that you're in. As it's at the top of my to-do list.
I love you both so dearly.
Love you,
lovers. I really do.
And, thank you so much for joining us.
In Bed with Nick and Megan is an Earwolf production. It's produced by Megan Mullally, Kevin Bartelt, and Michael Landry. Executive produced by Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon. Music by Nancy and Beth, which can be found at www.nancyandbeth.com. If you enjoyed In Bed with Nick and Megan, make sure to rate it and review the show on Apple Podcasts.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.